The universe provides so much power, yet we struggle to tap it and crave more. Instead of being powerless, let's get off Earth and conquer space. So today we continue the Upward Bound series and our look at how to get into space cheaper and easier, and what we can do up there once we can place stuff in orbit more cheaply. Of course, if you're up in space for a while, you'll need a reliable power supply, and that generally means either solar or atomic. In terms of the latter, fusion is a good option if we can ever get it working, but fission is not something folks want in orbit overhead in large quantities. The big weakness of ground-based solar are that it's useless on cloudy days and at night, but this is an area where being in space is actually a major advantage. When we refer to the dark void of space, we're being more poetic than accurate. Space near Earth is constantly lit brighter than the noontime sun, and indeed you have to get out beyond the asteroid belt before solar stops being as effective there as it is on most of Earth. The equivalent of darkness in space depends on your distance from the sun, or if something's in between you and the sun, placing you in the object's shadow. While any object in a classic low Earth orbit is spending a lot of its time in the relatively large shadow of the planet, as you get further away, less of your orbital path is in that shadow. Additionally, various non-circular orbits, or locations like the Lagrange points, have little to no time in shadow, eliminating most or all of the downtime experienced by solar panels situated on the Earth. As for wearing down over time, solar panels on Earth have to contend with dust, rain, snow, sandstorms, thermal fluctuations, and other weathering, none of which are present in the vacuum of space. And, needless to say, there are no clouds there either. The total benefit is about 7 times more kilowatt hours per year from a given photovoltaic solar panel. Perpetual lighting also eliminates most of the need for batteries. All of which makes solar an excellent choice for space. It's much more attractive than on Earth, and of course we're interested in getting that energy to Earth, whether beamed down or otherwise, and eventually to other places in space. The idea has been looked at a lot for decades, but is becoming increasingly feasible now that launch costs are plummeting. For this to be practical though, we have to overcome certain issues, and we should start by laying those out. First and foremost, getting stuff into space is expensive. Doing that cheaper is, after all, what this series is mostly about. A solar panel in space might be several times more effective than one on Earth, but if you need to spend hundreds of times more money to get that panel up there, while it remains useful for powering things up there, it wouldn't really make sense to beam it down. Not when you can far more easily deploy and maintain conveniently sized arrays of panels down here. But down here, you have to add energy storage, which is several times more expensive than PV panels, if you want to compare apples to apples. Second, there is the question of how you beam that energy down, and this comes with a lot of problems. For instance, if you're beaming down with a visible light laser, it still has to go through all that air and clouds. There is also an additional effect called thermal blooming that causes laser light to be absorbed by the atmosphere over any significant distance, at least for frequencies that interact with the atmosphere. You also lose energy at every stage of the process, as you convert sunlight to electricity, then into lasers, then down to Earth through the atmosphere, into a collector there, and back into electricity again. We'll be looking at these problems, some solutions, and some alternatives to visible light today in greater detail. But that brings up a third issue, which is safety. A big giant laser is also known as a death ray, and with any power beaming system, you are directing a lot of energy into a potentially small place. This is a serious problem if your beam goes off target from the collector and over to a city, be that as a result of an accident or deliberate action, so we'll be looking at ways you'd be trying to make one safe to use. It is also worth remembering though, that a giant laser in space also has some handy uses, like blowing up incoming asteroids or space junk, not to mention it's a great way to push spaceships up to high speeds. So we will also be discussing some of the non-terrestrial uses of power satellites later on, though our main focus is getting energy to Earth. At this point, we have to start considering scale. At present, humanity uses energy from all sources combined at an average power rate of about 18 terawatts, 18 million megawatts, not including the solar energy used by photosynthesis and evaporation. That's about 2,400 watts per person, day in, day out, every day. And while we are getting a lot more efficient with power usage, we also have a lot of people in developing regions who don't use much yet, and hopefully will in the future. Hopefully not too much or too soon though, because our main method of power generation has concerns about heating up the planet. We should start with a note there then, as folks often worry about power satellites heating the planet by adding more energy, which of course they do. The thing is, it isn't our direct use of energy that's heating the planet. While we use energy at an 18 terawatt rate, Earth receives about 10,000 times that energy from sunlight. The extra heat we add would be trivial on its own. The concern is with the greenhouse gases being released and trapping an additional fraction of the solar energy, not the extra energy we consume directly. However, power satellites are solar powered, so were that a concern, you could just have them block incoming light to Earth, cutting down on how much reaches us. Not that you'd bother, since you could easily use a MEO to do the job, which is cheaper, thinner, and a lot less complex for such a geoengineering purpose. 18 terawatts is a huge amount of power, and even our most efficient experimental solar panels, though still being worked on in a lab, would only get you about 600 watts per square meter in orbit. To get up to 18 terawatts, you'd need 30,000 square kilometers of our best panels, or a single panel 100 kilometers in radius. That wouldn't include any losses in transmission either. Fortunately, we can assume high efficiency panels are used, as the single biggest cost to deploying a power satellite is launch cost, which we'll discuss in a moment. Solar panels will continue to get lighter, cheaper, more durable, and more efficient as time goes on. But for the moment, if we use our top-end figures for performance, we can do a panel with thickness as low as 2 millimeters, massing only about 2 kilograms a square meter, and generating about 600 watts per kilogram in space, constantly. To get 18 trillion watts out of 600 watts per square meter would require 30 billion square meters, or 30,000 square kilometers, at an approximate mass of 60 billion kilograms. At current launch costs, that could run nearly $100 trillion, and doesn't include any losses in transmission or other associated equipment. However, these would likely have a lifetime of 20 to 30 years, and since the energy sector is several trillion dollars a year, with estimated figures varying widely, spread out over 20 to 30 years, this would already be approaching a competitive cost. As manufacturing continues to improve and launch costs drop, this could get us into the economically feasible zone for power satellites rather quickly. And now would seem a good time to start prototyping to see if this can be made viable as launch costs drop. However, this is SFIA, so we are less interested in the next decade than the next century, and the earlier episodes of this series discuss mini launch systems that we already have the tech for that can drop launch costs to a tenth or even a hundredth of what SpaceX's Falcon Heavy can do. As a reminder, stuff like Jim Powell's StarTram, or Keith Lofstrom's Launch Loop, or Paul Birch's Orbital Ring are not all that high tech. They just have a big upfront cost, many billions of dollars, which only looks big since we don't actually spend our relatively small space budget on launching truly massive things. Our annual ground-to-space launch volumes are tiny compared to a single day's traffic through any major airport. And same as you don't build an international airport next to a small village, you don't build these kind of launch systems till you are ready to up your game and launch a lot more, not because they are particularly high tech. When you are thinking about replacing a multi-trillion dollar sector of the economy, options like those launch alternatives suddenly become much more attractive and profitable. See those episodes for details. But even the most expensive of them are offering launch costs smaller than the production cost of the power satellites. It's also worth noting that much of their operational cost is electricity, which, needless to say, is altered when you're launching gigawatt-sized power generators into orbit. Additionally, most of the weight of a panel is still silicon, the second most abundant element on the moon's surface, right after oxygen. Nor are solar panels incredibly tricky to produce, especially when mass and efficiency isn't much of an issue, and the moon is close enough for us to do remote operations, so any factories there do not need much personnel physically present to operate, or sophisticated artificial intelligence. Before we move on, I should also note that photovoltaics, turning photons into electricity the way a solar panel does, is not the only way to turn light into electricity. We could, for instance, just concentrate light on a liquid in pipes so it heats up, boils, and turns a turbine, a thermal power sat, like the prize-winning flower sat design. This is a viable way of generating power, provided the light is sufficiently intense, and sunlight can be made incredibly intense. Thermal methods are how most power generation occurs, using an atomic or chemical fuel source for heat instead of sunlight. If you can't make cheaper solar panels, you can always use a bunch of thin, parabolic mirrors and non-imaging light funnels to focus light on some substance to heat it and drive a fairly standard heat engine. Getting rid of waste heat during the cycle is harder, when you can only remove heat from a system in space by radiating it, but you can still use cooling by conduction and forced convection inside it. The backside of all those mirrors can also be used for radiating surfaces too. Even surfaces exposed to sunlight can potentially be used to radiate waste heat by use of wavelength selective surfaces. Okay, so we can collect it up there, but how do we get it down? The traditionally suggested method is microwaves in a beam, which worries folks a bit since we also use those to heat up our food. They'll heat up a person or a city just as well. We'll get to the safety issues in a bit. First, why microwaves? They are not the only option, but in terms of our spectrum, the atmosphere does a very good job keeping out virtually all gamma and X-ray radiation, and the overwhelming majority of ultraviolet too, so they're not great wavelengths to use to get our energy past the atmosphere. Visible light goes through pretty well, obviously, but much is still lost even in an open sky, and clouds obviously are murderous on visible light transmission. Don't discard it just from that, though. Power satellites all around the planet can just retarget their beams to collectors not obscured by the clouds, and only on the cloudiest days will we not have clear sky windows which some power sats could use to get an angle on the ground-based collectors. I should also note that we always want other power generation methods and energy storage in any power grid anyway, so that some ground-based collectors being blocked by clouds sometimes is not really a deal-breaker for visible light. Nor do you necessarily need to beam light down as a laser. A big parabolic dish concentrating light on ground-based collectors is an option too, which gets around thermal blooming that happens when a high-powered laser enters a medium, like air, that's absorbing some of it and heating up and scattering the beam a lot. This, by the way, is a really big issue for using ground-based lasers to intercept missiles or using lasers for ultra-high bandwidth data transmission over long distances. Since part of the point is to get power down at night, using the visible range of the spectrum in broad diffuse beams could cause a lot of light pollution, though in some places this might be advantageous. Of all the spectrum, radio waves are the ones that basically ignore the atmosphere and clouds the most overall, and microwaves, which are shorter than radio waves in wavelength, which is where the name micro comes from, are quite good at going through our atmosphere, clouds or not. You might wonder about the danger of this, but if you are accessing this episode over a wireless network, I should note that those use microwaves too, and the same frequency as your microwave oven. There's nothing very special about that frequency, by the way. It's just in a small band that the FCC leaves free for non-broadcast purposes. Equipment operating at these frequencies is also pretty efficient at converting between electricity and microwaves, especially compared to lasers. You can do better than 75% with a magnetron converting electricity into microwaves, whereas laser efficiency, as much as it's improved, is still generally more like 50%. Our best new laser designs can almost match that, But historically, lasers have been much less efficient. Microwaves remain better, but not by the same overwhelming margin. Here's the thing though, a rectenna, a specialized type of antenna for absorbing these microwaves and turning them back into electricity, has an efficiency of at least 85%, much better than our best solar panels. This means that any side effect environmental heating from beamed in microwaves will be much less as well. Now, as to safety concerns, the general notion is to beam the energy in at about 100 watts per square meter, non-coincidentally what OSHA says is the maximum safe workplace exposure amount. To get 18 terawatts, and keeping in mind 15% is lost in conversion by rectennas, would require about 200,000 square kilometers of rectenna collector surface area. Sounds big, and indeed it is. That's about the size of Nebraska. Not that you'd be putting them all in the same place. More to the point, that doesn't really seem much better than covering huge chunks of land with solar panels. Of course, you could just increase power density and fence the plate off, but you'd still be blowing birds away left and right and potentially have a doomsday weapon. Though, realistically, you could ramp the beam intensity up an order of magnitude without producing too much of either problem. Birds would tend to avoid them as uncomfortable or be able to swoop through before being hurt. This is mostly just raw heat damage, like being too near your fireplace, after all. However, the neat thing about a rectenna is that you can use multiple of them to cover a wide area, and this area is not entirely lost to you, as a rectenna is a mesh more like chicken wire than an opaque glass panel, and tougher too. Indeed, you could beam it right down on a city and provide wireless power, though obviously you'd want to be careful about concentrating it too much. Incorporating solar panels into roads and parking lots obviously has extreme issues with durability, while sticking a layer of chicken wire over farm fields or grazing land isn't difficult, nor is it that hard to concentrate such beams to such sizes and keep them on target, nor will they torch a fiery furrow through the landscape as they go. But the optical considerations of microwaves means that rectennas receiving gigawatts will necessarily be large, usually several kilometers across. Safety is easily achieved by having the emitter and collector handshake, and the beam just shuts off if it goes off target. I should probably note that an optical version of this, using nanotech and metamaterials, called the Nantenna, shows promise of achieving a 70% or higher conversion of optical light frequencies to electricity. The impact of this emerging technology on solar panels, ground or space-based, might be immense and very near at hand. Again though, this is SFIA. In this series, it's only been a few episodes since we were talking about orbital rings, the great big rings around planets for getting into space once we want to be moving millions of people and megatons of cargo back and forth between space and the ground on a daily basis. An orbital ring is far cheaper, kilogram for kilogram, than any other options, and you can scale it up immensely if you want to, unlike rockets, where that kind of throughput would also produce enough pollution and heat to mess with your climate. If you want to do a lot of travel from ground to space, and you love your planet, you should put a ring on it. While the massive drop in launch cost is certainly handy, the orbital ring also brings some benefits from being directly connected to the planet below. You can run tethers and lines down to the surface, without making them of supermaterials like graphene, though you may still want to use graphene in particular, since recent improvements are being made in producing it in bulk, and it's quite a good conductor of electricity. But the important point is that tethers going from the ring to the planet need only be reasonably strong, not space elevator strong, and don't have to be rigid or run in straight lines. Because of this, they can be built with some extra features in mind, such as transmitting power, bringing people or cargo to and from the cities near the ring, and can do so without a lot of the hassle of something like a rocket. You can't launch a rocket anywhere near a city, or any sort of spaceship meant for that kind of speed and acceleration, not without damaging the city or even killing people, so you'd have to commute to a launch pad far from that city and any of its suburbs. Alternatively, an orbital ring tether can leave from any terminal in that city as easily as a train or subway, allowing direct transport of people from a city up to the ring. And for that matter, they can also transport up heat, something we might discuss more in the future. But this is interesting in the context of Ekumenopolises, planet-wide cities, or their little brothers, arcologies, in that it means space-based power generation is actually better than fusion, because a fusion reactor is still producing a lot of waste heat in the process of making electricity. Power plants generally lose over half their energy to heat loss in making electricity, even before it hits the power grid, where even more is lost to the resistance on the lines. But a solar panel in space, running electricity right down a cable to a city, or for that matter a reactor in space doing the same, is not producing one extra drop of heat on Earth that isn't in the grid. So no heat is being produced due to electricity production waste, though of course all that electricity will end as heat, either in the wires or at your house. It's just not leaving half or more back at the power plant. Orbital rings are a major investment, and they also aren't local. You have to encircle the whole planet. We do have another option, which can be done strictly at one location, and that is to build Kármán space towers. I call them that because they reach the Kármán line, which is the generally accepted line between our atmosphere and space. Even with our material science today, we can build such a lightweight structure using carbon fiber materials. We might even squeak by without having to resort to newer construction techniques too. As many of you will be aware though, here at SFIA, we are very much in favor of using active support systems to build higher and stronger. See our episode on space towers, and particularly the Atlas Pillar, for how to do that. As a brief recap, we support the tower by using a series of fountains of material propelled through the tower. Our Kármán towers are lightweight Atlas pillars poking above the atmosphere with an energy collector at the top. Now the atmosphere does not abruptly end as you go into space. At the Kármán line, which is 100 kilometers up, the air density is about 2.2 million times less than at the surface. That's handy for power generation, as we'll see. Should you have trouble building quite that high, much of the advantage remains from going shorter, but taller is better. Atlas pillars take a lot of power to keep them supported. How much depends on your efficiency regenerating the momentum of the support material. In theory, that could be a 100% efficient closed loop, but we're not there yet, and these would use a fair amount of power. You might ask, what is the point of having a Kármán tower that consumes some of the power it produces, when you could just beam the energy to the ground instead? The answer is the energy collector is in space. Having the collector in space handily gets around a lot of the transmission losses and other problems we discussed, like thermal blooming, light pollution, hazards to animals, and the trade-off of concentration for safety. You can skip a lot of these steps by just having big mirrors and parabolic dishes that can point at a large array of solar collectors fanned out on the top of that tower and flood the panels with as much light as they can handle. And those mirrors can bounce light to the night sky collectors just fine, as well as filter out any frequencies we can't use well, or which might degrade the panels. You stick one just north of a city so it never shadows it, and run a low resistance power line down it, and now that city has a good power supply, and a popular tourism spot, since looking down from 100 kilometers up gives a breathtaking view of everything for 1,000 kilometers around. It also has virtually no footprint on the ground, is very safe if there's a power loss, offers ultra-high efficiency power transfer, and provides direct access to space and a launch system. See the Space Towers episode for more on this. Another thing that having a direct connection between space and the ground gives us is an ability to deal with the heat produced at the converter. In space, the only way to get rid of the heat is to radiate it away, which requires giant radiators. It's also less efficient than using convection and conduction, which are cooling options only available on the ground. If we pipe the heat back to Earth, we can much more easily dissipate it. We can also use the heat as a source of power in its own right, or use it as a way of desalinating water with coastal Kármán towers. Come to think of it, I like the idea of a steampunk solution. We generate steam at the collector and use the steam pressure as part of the active support of the tower itself. We also tap it for energy using turbine generators and then pump the cooled fluid back up to the collector. The entire structure could be a giant steam engine converting the steam to electricity as we go. Traditionally, you do this with magnets, launching material up a mass driver that's slowed down and deflected back by a receiver up top, but in theory, any flow of matter works. So power satellites seem a much more attractive option, and a potential gateway to space as launch costs drop. We've talked about many industries that might fuel a snowball effect to help us get into space, science, tourism, even filmmaking. But which of these can match energy, a market making up roughly 10% of our global economy, and the biggest bottleneck on greater prosperity for humanity in this modern era? Get power satellite operations down to even just near the price per kilowatt hour of other existing sources, and it not only could power our homes here on Earth, but our efforts to make homes off Earth. And certainly the power demands to manufacture space habitats will be much higher than that sized for the habitat's ongoing domestic consumption. So even if power generation was the first piece of infrastructure built, additional power could be beamed to construction projects as needed, or even as emergency power later. Indeed, temporary beamed power for space projects, such as mining and construction, could be a major space industry in itself. And its applications aren't just for Earth and near Earth, as we'll see next week when we continue our discussion of generation ships to colonize distant stars. One of the hardest parts about traveling in deep space is getting up the speeds necessary to do it on reasonable timelines and to provide power to those ships far from the sun, but still needing to keep warm and lit for those who dwell inside. You can beam power out quite a long way, and you can use it to help ships get up to speed. Of course, slowing down is another matter, and one we'll discuss next week in Exodus Fleet. Electricity is the life's blood of all our science and industry here on Earth, and will be for those ships too. And fundamentally, as launch costs drop and solar panel efficiency rises, power satellites can offer us a virtually unlimited supply of electricity without the ecological problems or supply bottlenecks of our current energy options. We had to gloss over a lot of the discussion of the basics of electromagnetism, induction, current, heat engines, and other core topics that explain how power generation and transmission is actually done, and why some of those methods we looked at today are better than others. If you'd like to learn more about those topics, or just brush up on them, then I'd recommend the Regents Physics Reviews. Those courses step through basic physics and some more advanced material in a detailed and professional fashion, never skipping over terms by assuming folks already know them, but also not dumbing things down either. Those are available over at Skillshare, an online learning community that focuses on assembling classes on technology and has courses on everything from basic sciences to a lot of modern software. And I've been using a lot of their classes on video production, audio engineering, and animations to improve the content here on the channel. If you want to improve your skills, unlock new opportunities, and do the work you love, give Skillshare a try, and a premium membership gives you unlimited access to classes like those. If you want to join me and the millions of other students already learning on Skillshare, we have a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for free. To sign up, go to skl.sh/isaac2. Again, go to skl.sh/isaac2 to get 2 months of unlimited access to over 20,000 classes for free. Act now for this special offer and start learning today. As mentioned, next week we'll be returning to our topic of generation ships to look at ways to provide them the power they need to cover huge interstellar distances in reasonable times and to keep their crew alive during those voyages through the empty ocean of space. The week after that, we'll be teaming up again with Joe Scott of Answers with Joe to look at some of the potential catastrophes humanity might have to deal with before we can get out there and settle the galaxy, and the ways we might avoid those, mitigate the damage, or recover afterwards. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel, and if you enjoyed this episode, hit the like button and share it with others. Until next time, thanks for watching, and have a great week.
We'll be right back.